Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
It's Friday, so it's time for our week in review. We just heard last hour Governor Charlie Baker give the latest on the coronavirus pandemic in Massachusetts and a little more on how the state plans to start phase one opening next week. What will that look like? And what stood out to you from this week in the outbreak? How would you rate the governor's handling of the crisis? And now the slow march toward reopening. Call us. Join our Week in Review. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us is WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg, who helped us cover the press briefing last hour. Hi there, Carrie.
Hello there, Tiziana.
And our Week in Review panelists, Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. Hello there, Renee.
How are you, Tiziana?
I'm well, thanks. And Jennifer Braceras, political analyst and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So Renee and Jennifer, you know, Carrie and I had a chance before the start of the show to chat about Governor Charlie Baker's coronavirus briefing last hour. I know you both were listening in, so let me start by just asking you for reactions of what you heard. Renee, why don't you jump in?
Well, you know, I think it's obviously clear that the governor is still deciding what he's going to say on Monday. He really revealed nothing. But I did think it was interesting that he kept saying, you know, we don't want to let the virus out of the barn. The virus is already out of the barn. It's not contained. And he keeps saying that we need to respect the virus, but the virus is going to dictate the timeline for loosening restrictions, you know, not the governor. He wants to get this right, because he understands that the margins of error are frighteningly thin with this.
And Jennifer Braceras, he said again today, as he has said repeatedly, listen, I know people would like us to go faster, but I'm, as Renee says, I don't want to let this thing back in. What was your reaction to his kind of responses about the pushback he's getting about the speed of the plan and the pace at which we'll be reopening?
Well, on the one hand, I agree with Renee. The virus is out there. You can't put it back in, right? It's like Pandora's box. On the other hand, it's going to be with us for a very long time. And we don't know when there will be a cure. We don't know when there will be a vaccine. There may never be a vaccine. We don't have a vaccine for SARS. We don't have a vaccine for a lot of things. And so the question is, how can we start to resume life in a way that is as safe as possible, that balances the costs and benefits and the risks, to society? Because I think we can all agree that we can't live like this for the next 2 years.
Carrie Goldberg, what about what Jennifer just said? We don't have a vaccine for some of these other viruses. I know President Trump today announced a big initiative on vaccines at the federal level. In your healthcare reporting, what are you seeing about the likelihood and the promise of vaccine development for this virus?
Well, it's a very mixed picture. There's certainly incredibly energetic work going on a vaccine. Actually, I heard just today in a press call, Dan Baruch, who's a real leading vaccine researcher here in Boston, said, if everything went perfectly and no promises and science will break your heart every time, but it is conceivable that we could have a vaccine by the end of the year. And this was, he was not being political. This was a scientific point of view. But it's also definitely true that we might have a vaccine never. And so it's like you have to plan. And you can hear Baker planning for the next few months because, as he said, there are so many things that we don't know, and we don't know whether we're going to have a vaccine either. So we have to proceed.
So Carrie says best case scenario, right? Best case scenario, everything goes as we'd like it to, vaccine by the end of the year. That doesn't mean that people are vaccinated by the end of the year. That means we have a vaccine by the end of the year. And then comes the long and arduous process of getting people vaccinated on an equitable basis and on a needs-based basis. And so that is another, 3 months?
So let's hone in on that for a second. You asked a rhetorical question there, Jennifer, but I want to hone in on it. Renee Graham, Jennifer said in an equitable manner, are we built to issue a vaccine, let's say, over a 3 to 6 month period in an equitable manner, given what we've seen in terms of issues around equity in this pandemic?
Not at all. I mean, I don't think there's any question that there are going to be people who are not going to be able to get this vaccine for any number of reasons. So how are you going to, it's not like, as you said, that you have a vaccine is the same thing as saying everyone is suddenly vaccinated. So who's going to have access to the vaccine? Who's going to get vaccinated? Who's going to be left out? And what that's going to mean for this virus going forward? You know, I just think it's you know, it's interesting. There's a group of state legislators that sent a letter to Governor Baker today asking him to delay easing of the stay-at-home advisory until at least June 1st. And the idea is that all these benchmarks haven't been made, but a big point that they made was that they have to deal with these populations that have been disproportionately affected. And if the same ways that people have been disproportionately affected by the virus, they're also going to be disproportionately affected in terms of getting that vaccination, if there ever is a vaccination.
That is all true. But what is also true is that many of those same communities of color and you know, working class and poor communities are disproportionately impacted by the shutdown. And so that is the double bind that we find ourselves in.
Very true.
So absolutely. I want to give Carrie Goldberg a chance to jump in here. But before I do, just quickly, listeners, pull up a chair at the table. What I want to know from you is, what are you expecting to hear from the governor next Monday? What do you think you're going to hear? What do you want to hear from the governor next Monday? And do you think those will be the same thing? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Carrie, I think I just heard you in the background a couple of times. And since none of us can see each other, I wanted to just turn in your direction and give you a chance to jump back in here.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's really just, again, it's a terrible bind. It's people are suffering on, there's the potential for suffering on both sides. People are already suffering. And you could, again, coming back to Governor Baker, you could hear him saying, look, you know, a vaccine is still hypothetical. We're doing pretty well at this point, but this doesn't end until we get through the fall. And so what we're looking for on Monday is a sense of what will be happening in the coming weeks and months. And my overwhelming sense at this point is that we will not get a simple roadmap on Monday. We will get a sort of a set of contingencies that will need to be fluid in terms of if the data changes. We know that when we reopen, we can expect that there will be more cases again. And so how many cases before we do the next thing, et cetera.
Okay. So Jennifer, Carrie, Renee, Renee, jump in and then I'll go to what I wanted to do. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just think that people should sort of consider somewhat what happened in South Korea in the past week, where they reopened nightclubs. And from one man who went to five clubs, they've had this ripple effect from this outbreak. They've had more than 150 people infected so far from this one man. And now they're testing more than 46,000 people because of this ripple effect from, you know, who he contacted and who they contacted. You know, and South Korea has been a model for other countries because of its early and robust response to the coronavirus. But I think what happened last week there also says how easy it is to get this wrong.
I guess what troubles me, and I completely understand what Renee is saying, but there seems to be this notion that we have that opening up means going from 0 to 60, and that opening up means all of a sudden packing into bars like they were in Wisconsin and going to nightclubs like they were and have been in South Korea. And a lot of the things that are frustrating people is not the inability to pack into nightclubs, but the inability to do simple things like play tennis with a relative or kick a soccer ball around with three friends. I mean, those are sort of the things where people are feeling, okay, enough. I don't need to go to a bar, but let me get outside and, you know, do something with a friend.
Well, let's just see how
I want to put three pieces aside. Let me grab this here because I think it's going to kind of bring our conversation forward a little more. I'm going to put together three pieces of sound for you, and I think they represent the kind of the continuum of what we're talking about here. First, here is Governor Baker on Wednesday talking about which businesses might be able to reopen based on next Monday's plan.
I would love to be able to open everything up tomorrow. That would be an incredibly irresponsible thing to do. What we are going to do is phase the reopening. The folks who are going to open initially are going to be the folks who we believe are most likely to be successful in reopening and not further spreading the virus.
Okay, so put next to that something that Mayor Marty Walsh, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, told us this week on Radio Boston. And this is about how he doesn't want the state to get the reopening plan wrong because of how much there is at stake.
We only have one shot at getting it right. And what I don't want to see is a situation where we open up, like what I'm hearing in Georgia, where they opened up everything really quickly, and then all of a sudden their cases are spiking right now again, at least a little bit, I guess, from what I understand. That's not a situation that we can, that's not going to be healthy to the economy here.
Now, on the other hand, Renee already mentioned that there was a group of people that wrote to the governor encouraging him to extend the current sort of regulations until June 1st. But there's a group of Republican state lawmakers who are calling on the governor to accelerate his plan to reopen. Among them is Bill Ricka State Representative Mark Lombardo, who told WBUR that many of the small businesses that will be blocked from reopening in the governor's phase one, or that he's assuming will be, should be able to decide for themselves.
They know their businesses better than government and certainly better than any advisory board. And we should really put some standards in place for safety and allow these small businesses to go execute on that. They can get, you know, back operating, get people back to work, and do so in a safe way.
So much tension here around how quickly, how much, what we're frustrated with, like Jennifer said just before I brought that sound in, and how much should be a matter of individual choice. Has the governor been threading that needle appropriately?
Who are you asking?
Anybody.
I think he's probably tried.
There's one, I got to tell you, what a fantasy. For once, I didn't have to wrestle apart 72 guests to not have them. Renee, why don't you jump in first?
You know, I certainly think he's trying to do that. And I think that's why he is, you know, proposing this sort of tiered approach. You know, I think that certain things like personal services, like haircuts and nail salons and beauty salons, you know, might be much later in the process. But at this point, we really don't know, you know, what he's proposing. We won't know until Monday. I just think that, you know, the idea that everyone should be allowed to decide what works. The problem with that is, it's not just about you. It's about keeping other people safe as well. And somehow that seems like that message just isn't getting through to certain legislators. It's not just about keeping myself safe. It's about keeping my neighbors safe and people I walk with, walk around in the grocery store with. That's the idea. So it's not just an idea that people should do what they feel is right for them. It's not just about them. It's about all of us.
Jennifer.
Tiziana, I think that the one thing I would add, one thing that the governor has been clear about over and over and over again is that we must be guided by the data. And I really can't quarrel with that. And so what I expect is that there, as we have this phased reopening, we will be doing lots of testing and watching the data, and that will determine what the next step can be.
Well, I mean, Carrie, people keep talking about being guided by the data, and yet we're making really arbitrary distinctions that have no basis in data. So for example, liquor stores are open, but bookstores are not. I mean, if you're a bookstore owner, I can see why that would be an extremely frustrating line that's been drawn. And for example,
isn't there a public health reason though to avoid withdraw from alcohol?
Yes.
I mean,
exactly.
I have heard that argument that there's a public health dimension to make sure that alcohol is available.
You can say that, but that's not the reality. The reality is, as a political matter, regular people, not alcoholics, would have thrown a complete hissy fit if liquor stores had shut down. Let's just admit that, myself included, okay? And so it was just, no, it was based on political groveling to the masses that would have clamored for that. I mean, it's not a public health thing. It's just not. And there are a lot of, uncharted territory, and we're all drawing arbitrary lines every day with our kids, with ourselves. And I understand there's going to be some degree of arbitrariness about it. But we have gotten to the point where people are very frustrated with those arbitrary lines. They are frustrated that their children are allowed to go and play golf, but not tennis, or that they are allowed to, you know, as I said, go to a liquor store and buy a pint and not go to a bookstore and pick up the latest novel quickly to go. I mean, that is starting to frustrate people.
All right, so we're going to be taking a break soon, but we've got some callers on the line. I'd like to get a couple caller voices in before we go to a break. So 1-800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK. Audrey is on the line from Alston. Audrey, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on the idea of the financial necessity for working class and poor people to get back to work. I absolutely understand that we need that in order to pay our rent and utilities and to live, but we will also be putting our lives on the line in order to go back to work. And if, you know, serving people who will throw a fit if they don't get their Americano, but don't care about whether or not we ourselves are exposed is really concerning. And I think it's unconscionable for anybody to argue for the financial benefit at this point.
And is that where you think we are, Audrey? Are we in that stage where that's the argument you feel like you're hearing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the reason that it seems as though the reason that the reopening is really becoming the popular conversation right now is obviously because the economy is hurting. And yes, of course, that is something that needs to be taken into account. But what good is a healthy economy if we have a wildly unhealthy and dying population, especially the people who do the most contact heavy jobs?
All right, Audrey, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. I want to turn it back to our panelists. Any one of the three of you that wants to react to that?
I mean, I don't know what Audrey's circumstances are, but what I have found is that most of the people making that argument are people whose income has not changed much. That's the truth. And my income hasn't changed, and I'm very fortunate in that regard. But most people who have been laid off, people who own small businesses, who are having trouble making their next payment, they do want the opportunity to reopen. And to them, it is, people are going to die either way. I mean, you know, when the stock market crashed in 2008, I heard one estimate that, you know, something in the amount of whatever, 5,000, some number of people died because they lost their health insurance, because they lost their jobs. The bottom line is economic hardship has health consequences, and it has consequences in terms of mortality in many ways. There are a lot of people right now who aren't going to get certain lumps checked, who aren't going to get colonoscopies because of this. And people, because of the shutdown, are also going to die. It's just a question of how we quantify these deaths and how you value those lives.
Well, at the same time, as we come back, yeah, Renee, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, then you're talking about, you know, who is valued and who isn't. So when you make the argument that, well, the people who were saying, who are talking about, well, you know, we have to protect these people, but aren't the people who've been hurt, make that argument in Chelsea. There's a reason why a city like Chelsea has the numbers it has, because those people are frontline workers, because they don't have sick leave, because they have to go out and work. And there has to be some balance between getting the economy. Look, nobody wants everything shut down forever. It's not working for anyone. But you also have to deal with the fact that people are getting sick and people are dying. Maybe that's okay for some people, but I think that's a problem. I think the attitude that, well, that's the way it goes, people are going to die.
No, of course not.
I'm not okay with that. I'm just not.
I think one of my colleagues, Hadley Manning, made this argument, and I've seen it pop up in several different places actually lately. And they've analogized this to the safe sex debates, you know, a couple of decades ago. And so, you know, people used to argue, we can't have abstinence-only education because, quote unquote, kids are going to do it anyway. So we need to teach them how to do it safely. And I think the same thing applies here. We can't shut down forever. We can't abstain from economic or social interaction forever. So we need to teach people how to do it safely.
And except AIDS was not as highly contagious as COVID-19 is.
Well, I would just insert here.
AIDS was much more deadly than
jump in here.
Let's
have Carrie jump in here, and then we're going to take a break.
It's just so much hinges on the question of, if we do everything we're supposed to, if we wear masks and if we wash our hands and if we keep our distance, how safe are we? If we're really super safe, then it makes more sense to go back to work. If this thing is so insidious that it somehow sneaks in anyway, then it's a whole different question. And I think we'll see that as things open up more. The great big hotspots like in Chelsea developed before we knew everything that we needed to do and were doing it. And now it may be a different picture.
With us having a lively conversation is Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham, Jennifer Braceras of the Independent Women's Forum, and WBUR's Carrie Goldberg, and you as well. Give us a call and join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I want to jump right into a couple of calls here after the break. We've got Jackie on the line from Worcester. Jackie, go ahead.
My name is Jackie, and I am a business librarian, and I also handle grants for nonprofits in Worcester. And I have to say, it was a comment Jennifer made before about that, you know, I respect what Governor Baker is doing. It's a hard decision to make, but I believe that arbitrary lines are being drawn. And for instance, I get to work remotely. I have not suffered economically, but it's been 2 months in lockdown, and we're not really going to benefit by another 15 days in lockdown added on to the 18th, another 30 days, et cetera. People have to get back to work. I, as a white-collar worker, have not suffered, but I know a lot of business owners who have and a lot of blue-collar workers. So we can't exactly hide from this virus. If you have a compromised immune system, if you're of a certain age and feel like you could fall victim to it, make it an individual choice not to go out there and, you know, get a haircut, go to a restaurant. But
Jackie, I'm going to take it back from you there. That's a good point. It's a good point. It's a point well taken. I want to make sure to get a couple other caller voices in too. I do want to grab Janet now. Janet is on the line from Cape Ann.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that, yes, of course, people want to get back to work, and yes, people need to feel safe. I don't know that the two issues, as hard as they are, really go together at all. I myself wanted to mention about a group of people who live in Massachusetts who are both deaf and blind, who have to touch everything to be able to find their way around or to communicate. And this group of people are incredibly, incredibly vulnerable. And when I think about things opening up, I say, well, how will it be safe for this group of people? That last caller made me feel like, well, if it's too tough for you to go out there, don't go out there. That is not fair at all. People
Janet,
need
thank
to go
you so
and
much.
Do what they need to do. But I also think it needs to
no,
be
Jen,
maybe
I'm so sorry. I don't mean to be rude, but I want to stay on that main point of yours because I don't want to lose it in the shuffle. You just made a very good point that I want to bring back to our panelists. So thank you for bringing it into the conversation. And Carrie Goldberg, I'm going to turn to you first on that last point we just heard from Janet.
Yes, I have been thinking about this so much, about when everyone goes back to work more, what happens to the people who have varying levels of risk? Like, what if you and I do the same work, but I'm a 70-year-old with a heart condition and high blood pressure, and you're a 32-year-old in perfect health? Will there be the same requirements for you and me to go back and take on that added risk? I'm so curious to see what the disposition will be for this question when the new rules come out.
And Jennifer and Renee, are those kinds of factors, do you think, even included in the planning, based on what we know about the 17-member advisory board, about the kinds of business associations and other associations that have been talking to the governor and his panel, are we making a plan that is, in essence, a mainstream plan?
I don't think there's any other way to do it. I mean, look, I personally am at a higher risk. I have a lot of autoimmune issues. And, you know, that is one of the big risk factors for people who not just catch it, but whose bodies sort of react to it in this overdramatic way where sort of your immune system then attacks your lungs. So I am at great risk. And I am not asking the world to slow down for me. I need to take precautions based on my risk level. And yes, we have to open slowly. And yes, we can't open everything at once. But there needs to be a sense that this is we're headed back. We're on a track and we're headed back. We cannot be told that this is going to last forever, that this is an indefinite thing. I think it's that psychological component that's very, very difficult for most people to deal with. And that is what, you know, we need to start slowly, very slowly, to reopen.
I want to grab another call here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Joseph on the line from Roxbury. Joseph, go ahead.
Good afternoon. The question I have is, why is this being politicized? Why aren't we just listening to the doctors who are telling us that this will cause more damage if we open too early? The question I have is, why is this like a Republican or a Democrat thing? Why not just let this be a science thing and we just open and go back to work when it's completely safe? I'm in Roxbury.
It's never going to be
completely
safe. It can never
More safe.
Well,
that's what I'm saying, more safe.
Most doctors.
Well, I want to get Renee in on this. Jennifer, I want to get Renee in on this too, just because we haven't heard her voice since we came back from the break. And Joseph, thank you for the call. I appreciate that. It's a question that allows us a lot of things we can talk about now. Renee, please do jump in.
I mean, a vaccine would be safe, but, you know, as it's been said, you know, time and again, we don't know if we're ever going to get a vaccine. So it is going to be about this sort of very thoughtful, very methodical approach to quote unquote reopening the state. At the same time, one size simply isn't going to fit all. And there's going to be a lot of trial and error in this. The problem, of course, is that the errors can result in people getting sick and dying. But, you know, it just has to be thoughtful. You know, when that caller earlier was talking about, you know, what's the effect going to be on the disabled community, I hope that that's been taken into consideration by the state. I hope they've thought about the fact that there is a more tactile experience and people have to touch things and how is that going to work? And I think that there simply have to be real rules in place. I think there has to, those, you know, social distancing rules will have to be enforced. I think that masks will need to be enforced if these businesses are going to reopen as they go through the process of that. If you look at what they're doing on the airlines have said, well, our crew and staff members will wear masks, but we're not going to demand that passengers wear masks. What sense does that make? You know, it's like they don't want to make a big deal and get people upset. Well, what's that going to do to the flying experience for a lot of people who would rather if everyone had to wear a mask? It's just a lot of figuring out. But yeah, I don't think people can wait until it's perfect. It won't be. But I think they have to really dig down and think deeply about how they're going to do this in the safest way possible, guided by the data and the science.
And I do think the medical community has raised some very important concerns about the mental health impact that this is having, particularly on children, and the educational and social impact this is having on children, with the disruption to their education and not seeing their friends and not being at school. And those are very real concerns as well. I do think, you know, everybody keeps saying, well, we have to listen to what the doctors say. Most doctors I know think that these other aspects of a person's medical health are also important.
Carrie Tiziana,
and I would
that,
just add, yeah, I love Joseph's question because I think it gets at something fundamental, which is that the scientists can do the numbers for you. They can do the models for you. They can tell you what's likely to happen if you do this or that. But ultimately, it actually is a political or at least a policy question. You've got these very difficult decisions. Let's say it's going to be that, like, you know, you can add $10 billion to the economy, which will help people, but 100 people will die. Now, that's a bad example, but something like that. These are actually sort of almost even philosophical or political questions that it actually needs to be the leaders who decide, I think, and then the voters later on can react to it.
So the other piece of Joseph's comment, though, and I want to get any three of you your reaction in the last minute or so before we go to hubbubs. He did say this is being politicized. Are we in a bizarre time when healthcare has been politicized for a long time, but when a serious pandemic issue is more in the realm of politics than it is in the realm of health?
Well, I mean, a situation like that, in my mind, is really just designed to cost lives. You know, if you have experts, if you have people who have spent their lives studying these issues, and you ignore what they're saying, then that's a problem. You know, it's not just about politicizing, then you're actually endangering people. And it also comes down to the idea that there are leaders deciding who in our society is expendable. That's what this feels like to me. When we're talking about, like, you know, what Jennifer was making the comment earlier about what's happening with kids, that is a real issue. But you also look at the kids, you know, if we've all gotten pushed back 10 miles, then what happens to the kids who were already 10 miles back? Now they're 20 miles back. So, right. You know, there's all these considerations I think that have to be made. What?
Exactly, which is why they need to go back to school. Those communities are most vulnerable.
They need to go back to school if everyone feels safe doing it, if parents feel safe sending their kids back, if teachers and staff members feel safe being there. You know, you've got this new sort of linked virus that kids are getting that's linked to COVID-19. People need to figure some of this stuff out.
I don't think it's about whether or not people feel safe going back. I think it is about whether we can go back safely in a way that limits but does not eliminate, because we can never eliminate the risk.
And so far, the polls keep saying that people think that things should go slower rather than faster. Those are the polls say.
Yes, and,
all right, so,
and my view is we should listen to the health experts, not the polls.
All right, so I'm going to stop us there. There's so much more we could talk about. And I want to give a shout out to all our callers. We're many, many callers that we didn't get to just now. People like Charlie in Attleboro, Brenda in Framingham. Sorry that we couldn't get to all of those calls. I do want to, before we end the Week in Review, though, leave a little time for our hubbubs, which are those local stories or events that caught our attention this week. Carrie Goldberg, why don't I have you go first?
Okay, so I've been reporting recently on antibody testing, which are, you know, those tests that tell you whether you have had the coronavirus. And I cannot think of a more perfect sort of item to express our times than the fact that in Cambridge, there's a bar called Wits End that was closed, of course, because bars are all closed. And so it had converted over to offering antibody testing to the population. Now, it was closed by Cambridge on Tuesday, but just the very idea that a bar turned into an antibody testing site is to me like the perfect expression of our times. And also the doctor who was running it told me that his brother, who owned the bar, wanted to give everybody a drink on their way out after they got tested, but he decided it was not medically appropriate, so they didn't.
Well, I love the spirit of that, for sure. Jennifer Braceras, what's your hubbub for today?
Well, I've sort of alluded to mine already, but I was going to talk about how the governor has opened golf courses across the state, but yet in many towns, including mine, tennis courts remain padlocked, and how that inconsistency is beginning to frustrate a lot of people. And when I mentioned that as my hubbub, Carrie actually sent me a petition that's going around, I guess, on change.org by I guess, the tennis playing community. I'm actually not a tennis player, but to urge the governor to open the tennis courts. So that's my hubbub for the day.
Well, golf got ahead of tennis. It's probably not the first time. It probably won't be the last. Renee Graham, let me turn to you. What's your hubbub for today?
As the daughter, niece, and cousin of military veterans, I was saddened to hear that the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund has canceled its annual Boston Common Flag Garden due to the pandemic. Of course, I understand why they made that decision, and it was the right decision. Yet I think a lot of us will really miss this point in tribute, this sea of more than 37,000 flags, especially at a time when so many veterans have been lost to this pandemic. I hope on this Memorial Day coming up, we'll also find ways to remember those who have given their lives to protect and serve this country.
You know, Renee, we have a little bit of extra time, and you've brought up a really, really important subject. What does it mean to you with somebody, you know, with family members who are being recognized? What does it mean to you to have flags like that out there?
You know, I used to work nearby, and I would always walk through around Memorial Day and look at it, and it was just such a striking and beautiful tribute. You know, all of these flags, and there was something just so evocative of what this country is supposed to represent, what these men and women have done for centuries to defend this country. And I do take military service quite seriously. As I said, I'm the daughter, niece, and cousin of military veterans. And it's, you know, we've heard so much about what's happened at the Veterans Home in Holyoke. And so I think veterans have been very much on my mind. And I really hope that, you know, since we might not all be out barbecuing this Memorial Day, that people sort of take a moment and really think of what the day means.
All right. And that is Renee Graham, the Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. Renee, I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jennifer Braceras, political analyst and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Thanks, Jennifer, for doing Week in Review today.
Happy to be here.
And my colleague, WBUR Common Health editor, Carrie Goldberg. Carrie, thanks for the ride along on the governor and for being on Radio Boston today.
You're very welcome, Tiziana.
Some Massachusetts hospitals have proven particularly effective at avoiding the spread of COVID-19. So what can we learn from them as we approach our statewide reopening? Dr. Atul Gawande says quite a bit. He's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and Harvard Medical School. He's also the former CEO of Haven Healthcare and now chairman of Haven's board and a staff writer for The New Yorker. He recently wrote about how our reentry can be modeled after what's being done in hospitals, and he joined us earlier today to talk about that approach.
Making it so hospitals were not sites of spread is an enormous amount of work, and you have to understand all the basics. At this point, everybody knows about them. It's about hygiene, distancing, screening for symptoms, and masks. Each of them have flaws. You skip one, it doesn't work. But taken together, and if you take them seriously, they've been able to shut down the virus.
So could you walk us through, like practically, you arrive at work in the morning, how a period of, let's say, 2 or 3 hours manifests across all of those categories of prevention?
Yeah. So first, when I arrive, right away we have a dispenser for hand sanitizer. And, you know, that's important. One thing about just hand washing that people may not recognize, more is better. Studies have shown that when you wash 10 times or more per day, that's when you get less. You get half of the infection rate. Now, what does that mean? That means anytime you enter into a high-traffic environment, or exit a high-traffic environment, then you want to wash hands or hand sanitize. You also, every 2 to 3 hours when you're in that environment with people, any group setting, you want to be washing your hands and then, of course, disinfecting the surfaces. Now, that's just about 5 to 10% of spread is from surfaces and your hands. Most is airborne. That's where distancing comes in, and we have the 6-foot distancing at work. The escalators, elevators, all of those things. We also know it's not enough. So the other...
Yeah, that's a little discouraging.
It is. Look, we have hundreds of thousands of people right now who are infected, and most have no symptoms yet. And that's why lockdown works, is we're just avoiding those people. At work, we can't avoid them. And it's actually less about the patients. It's about us. The patients are isolated. They're in their rooms. They're not coming and going. We, the workers, are coming and going, and that means we have to have additional elements. The two big additional elements. One is screening.
How does the screening work in your workplace?
Yeah, so we have a website, and on my phone, I've bookmarked it. I go to it every day when I go into the hospital at the Brigham. I screen. There's a bunch of symptom questions. I have to confirm I have none of those symptoms. And then I get a green pass that lets me walk in the door. There's someone checking for passes at all the main entrances, and then I can go into work. And that's critical. So, you know, we have, believe it or not, you know, the Mass General Brigham system has 75,000 employees. That's more than 75% of U.S. counties, and yet we've controlled this, right? And 50,000 of us showed up at work last month. So we're making the system work for all of us.
I do want to time out right there for a second, because I hear you, and I hear you loud and clear, and it's clearly been effective. Two things run through my mind. The first is, these are medical workers who are used to a different level of compliance and a different level of expectation. And second, are there civil liberty issues with, I'm not allowed into a building until I give my health information and get a green pass?
What they've got to know is, am I green or am I red for coming into work? So from the civil liberties point of view, perfectly okay, and it's been confirmed also against the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, the irony is that we as healthcare workers are not great about our culture has been that you go to work no matter what. It's embarrassing, but it's true. Like we've traditionally seen it as a sign of weakness that you take a sick day. And here is a complete change in our culture that's been required so that if you even have the hint of a cold, that, you know, your job is not to infect other people, that your job is to stay home. And that's been hard, right? Over the last 5 weeks, out of all of the 50,000 people who show up, 11,000 people have had symptoms, stayed home, and got tested. 1,400 of them turned out to be positive. And if we hadn't caught those, they wouldn't have stayed home, and then they would have been at risk of infecting others.
Yeah, and I want to stay on that for a minute, too, because your article really did emphasize this requirement of cultural change and also not going into work if you're showing symptoms. So let's go in reverse order, because that raises two questions. The first, one of the symptoms that you talk about is like runny nose. I keep thinking about allergy season and other basic things like that. Is it practical or desirable to keep people out of work for things like seasonal allergies because we just can't tell the difference?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's new symptoms, so people with seasonal allergies will have runny nose the entire, you know, spring.
Got it.
And so we're looking for those allergies, those things where it's new symptoms. That said, look, 90% of the time, this is just a cold or nothing. But 10% of the time, actually, you know, what I just told you with the statistics, it's about 15% that are turning out to have the virus when you have these really mild symptoms.
So that does bring up then the culture change question that I had. And it's a little bit complex, but we've done some call-ins on our program in the last couple of weeks, for example, around people wearing masks and questions about how do you get other people to wear them? And do you use shaming or do you use encouragement? And what drives that cultural change? I was taken, or I noticed in your article, you talked about people who have for years worked in this tough it out culture in healthcare. And you referred to that at the end of one paragraph as now that would be seen as showing shameful disloyalty. And I do wonder, what do we know about what incentivizes culture change? Is it a shaming-based approach? Is it an incentives-based approach? Is it a we're-all-in-it-together approach? What is going to work for the broader general public in getting people to share these behaviors that you're arguing are so fundamental to being able to safely reenter the economy?
Yeah, this is so critical because it turns out to be the fifth crucial pillar, which is the culture of keeping one another safe. It's critically about I protect you, you protect me. Our discussion in our culture right now is only about two values, safety and freedom. Keep me safe, leave me alone. The culture of the hospital that we've had to create, it's taking the culture of the operating room and bringing out to the hospital, and now we're trying to bring it out everywhere. And that's about never wanting to be the one to infect someone else, never wanting to be the one to put somebody in the morgue. And we're not vigilantes about it. That doesn't work. It doesn't work to scream at people. It's about the idea that we're in this together and that you can then say, hey, dude, your mask is down. And then they say, thanks. Or that you say to yourself, I got a cold coming on. I really don't want to be that person who could hurt somebody at work. We have to work at that. You have to find leaders and,
it does
and
sound
you have
hard.
To communicate it. And we have to communicate at the top level. It does not help that we have a president who's embarrassed to wear a mask, who does not want to communicate that, you know, we're in this together and that you can't do this. So it's up to the rest of us.
None of this is necessarily new, these steps, but there's a level of commitment and compliance that you're talking about. There are mental and social-emotional well-being impacts of embracing that as a truly new normal. How do you think about that as a physician?
Well, I think we have shown that we can do it with something that's enormously more disruptive and mentally disturbing for many people, which is locking yourself down in your house, right? This is taking that one step that allows us to actually get connected and be re-enter. It isn't about being perfect. None of these steps are perfect, but you put them together at a decent level of effectiveness.
All right, before we let you go, just this week you stepped down as CEO of Haven Healthcare, which was a joint venture between Amazon, JP Morgan Chase, Berkshire Hathaway. We said before, you will remain as chairman of Haven's board. What led you to this decision?
Well, partly it's where we are. This is an opportunity. We've got amazing people, and I've been able to move away from day-to-day management and shifting to greater focus on our overall vision and strategy. I'm very much staying involved. But it's also about finding that there's an opportunity then to be involved externally. As the CEO driving operations every day in and out, I had stepped back from being involved publicly. I'd not been writing at all for 18 months and not been involved in policy and public health in the same way, and I was happy to do that. The pandemic hit, and we reached a place where I felt the need to be stepping out publicly as well as continuing, and this was a win-win, a way that, all of it could happen.
How would you characterize the company's progress or success at this point, and will it have to pivot given this new normal that we're talking about?
Our job is focusing on our population of more than 1 million workers first, and we're making progress on solutions for better care and costs. But no question, COVID-19 is the most radical disruption of health and the healthcare system since at least World War II. I mean, right now, there's critical infrastructure in healthcare at risk, starting with the basic foundation of primary care, with large numbers of primary care physicians not being able to have enough income to keep their doors open. And we're not going to solve COVID-19, let alone improve the health of the country, if we're not able to address those larger healthcare issues. And there are dimensions here that absolutely require private sector involvement and innovation, like I get to be involved with Haven. But there's a lot more that also involves policy and leadership at broader levels.
Last question for you, Atul. You have experience at all levels of our healthcare infrastructure. Based on what you're seeing, do you see significant gaps, especially at the federal level, where you have a lot of experience, that we are going to need to address in that infrastructure?
Without question. This is a big opportunity. We have all experienced now moving 70 to 80% of practice into a virtual environment. We have to have a sustainable way to maintain that, and I think that's a big opportunity. We have to be able to use it so that it actually improves people's outcomes and care, and that it's not clear we're yet progressing to the place where we know how to do that. And then lastly, we have big parts of our specialty infrastructure that are in real danger. You have 70 to 80% of ophthalmologists and ear, nose, and throat clinicians, surgeons, who their practices have been completely shut down, and we need to have ways that can continue.
That's Dr. Atul Gawande. He's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Medical School. He's also the former CEO of Haven Healthcare and now chairman of Haven's board and a staff writer for The New Yorker. We spoke with him earlier today.